Greetings, this is the Automatically Deleted Husband. Yesterday was rather long, so I'm going to be brief, but I had dialogue on Luke 16. So I wanted to give some refinement and point out a few things very quickly. So that'll be the focus. One of the things that I think so vital is, again, as I've pointed out before, when you look at a particular verse or a particular chapter, it doesn't mean that what's before or what's after is not part of it. You know, a good example would be Matthew 5, 6, and 7. Obviously, usually collectively called the Sermon on the Mount, is one package. And there are so many places where, especially where you have a list of parables, well, you know, because obviously I started with Luke 16. But, you know, look at the way they're kind of grouped, and maybe one leads into another for a reason. For example, we go to Luke 15, you'll see a lot of these things. You know, it starts with the parable of the lost sheep, followed by the lost coin and the prodigal son. So you have those things, and what is it showing? It's showing Christ's concern for the lost. His concern is for people he wants. And it's the ones he wants. It's not saying that you have earned something. It's the ones he wants. And I do think one of the things we have to be reminded of is the last verse of the prodigal son. Boy, do I have this? I was thinking of the last verse of the another one, but anyway, it's the last verse of the Lazarus passage I want to mention. But either way, it's the whole idea of these things of 15 is I think Christ his concern for his sheep. But then I went through the dishonest manager in Luke 16 and obviously pointed to how it's very applicable to religious leadership of today, religious leadership in the institutional church. But in our dialogue, because again, I did take an hour. So, but again, look at it in context. What's the next verse? Verse 14. And also the Pharisees, being lovers of money, which is literally friends of silver, we're hearing all these things and we're deriding him. And it goes on. I won't try to be as long as yesterday. But one of the things I think is important to see, who are the Pharisees? The Pharisees, are we looking at particularly that group, or are we looking at characteristics of that group? I would suggest, just as he uses Jews and Gentiles or Greeks, for example, you'll see that term. Is he talking about people who are Greek, or is he talking about people who are non-Jew, or people that were simply different? I don't think he was talking so often about the Greek. I think he was talking in a greater generality. You will see where he does use a variety of terms. There's neither Jew nor Greek, Scythian and others and so forth. But so what is he talking about when he talks about the Pharisees? Is he talking about the particular group, which is, you know, a relatively small number of people? Or what is the characteristic about them that is important? One of the characteristics about them, they were valued, you know, from the history that I found of them, they valued their deeds, their position, and of course, they also stuck to the oral tradition, or what we know now as the Talmud. So it was their, I would suggest, their institution, their formality, and so forth, that defined them. And that they felt set them apart. What's the difference between that and the institutional church of today? Well, they don't use a Talmud. They use the Westminster Confession. I mean, it's London Baptist Confession, which, you know, again, is basically the Westminster Confession with a couple of minor changes. But they valued their group, their club, or their institution. And I would suggest, yes, those are the characteristics of being, you know, again, the lovers of silver and things of that nature. But also, it is like when we talk about, or when the Lord talks about the Greeks, I think it's a generality. When he talks about the Pharisees, I think it's also, we could consider it probably a generality. He's talking about religious leadership. So it's not just that group then, but it's the group now. So you have that passage, but then you have an interesting one verse that kind of, is this disjoint? And I would suggest, no, it's not. Luke 16:18. Everyone who is sending his wife away and marrying another commits adultery. And everyone who is marrying her sent away from a husband commits adultery. It's kind of like, how does that apply in this context? And I would suggest it does. Because what is a characteristic, what are the, one of the numerous characteristics that we see about the relationship in a marriage and the relationship of Christ and his elect? As I've mentioned many times, the relationship of Christ and his elect is reflected by the relationship between the husband and the wife. It is very much mirrored, and we have the blatant Ephesians 5:25, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church, or the assembly, or his elect. So Christ's love for his bride, the bride of Christ, his elect, is supposed to be reflected by the husband's love for his bride. And so the command, his statement that he will never leave or forsake his elect, the husband has to do the same. And obviously the idea of sending away, which some translations use the term divorce, which gives the license for people to say, oh, that means a state decree. Not at all. It is, again, apoluo, to send away. It is what the husband does. It is not what an institution, the state or the institutional church, does. Again, they weren't involved at all until the 1500s. Council of Trent, Book of Common Prayer, and so forth, that's when the institutional church got involved. Before that, they weren't involved at all. So it's been read in. So you have this idea of a husband sending away his wife. Don't do this, is what he's saying. Why is it in context here? You know, we were talking about the unjust manager. We're talking about the Pharisees being lovers of money, or again, friends of silver. The idea that the law will not pass away, and so forth. And what is one of his laws? It's the idea of a marriage. Marriage is a really big deal. You know, in the Ten Commandments, you shall not commit adultery. It's a rather big deal. And so one of the things it does here is it makes it clear. As Romans 7 and 1 Corinthians 6 makes clear, a wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives. It says that twice. Why? Again, Romans 7 says, for those who know the law. The reason being is because it's clear, it's obvious. It's Old Testament and New, consistent. Somebody summarized it as, marriage begins with sex and ends with death. Oh yes, that would be me. I would suggest that that's very clear. So I would, again, contend that this is consistent. The managing process that we see at the beginning, or with the Pharisees and their manipulation of the law and so forth, manipulation of the law in marriage, same. It's the same thing. A dishonest manager, someone who has authority, what does a husband have? Authority over his wife. And it's a dishonest husband who would put away his wife at his volition. Obviously, the only case where you can put away your wife is if your wife has the sexual immorality, as you know, the adulterous wife, for example. But again, that means you put her away. In other words, you're no longer responsible for her. It does not free you up from remarriage. So, but anyway, the other thing that we go on is the rich man and Lazarus, which obviously it's a fascinating story. But to keep this short, the last verse. And he said to them, if they do not hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded if one may rise out of the dead. So Jesus says this, obviously, before the crucifixion and resurrection. And so what is he talking about? He is talking about, even if what's going to happen here in a little while, that I will die and I will rise again, and I'll be able to, you'll see this in front of you. Even if that happens, it won't persuade people. So if they don't hear Moses and the prophets, the fact that Christ died and rose from the grave, that won't convince anybody. It is really serious evidence that he is who he claims to be. You know, he said he could put his lay his life down, and he has the power to pick it up again. We don't have that kind of power. Basically, you kill somebody, they can't on their own volition say, okay, I'm done with being dead, I'm going to rise again. Christ did. Again, he said it. He said it clearly. He did it on his own authority. You know, he's God. But so you have 15 is more the idea of the importance of the law. 16 is a lot about leadership. Leadership in the sense of managing God's house, which is what I suggest is exactly what the words used. The steward over the household. You know, you're over a household, and very applicable. Who would be the richest man ever? God himself. So, you know, I think that's, but then it goes to, you know, after 16 comes 17. And what I find interesting, it's listed as the temptation to sin. He said to his disciples, it isn't possible for the stumbling blocks to come. It is impossible for the stumbling blocks not to come, but woe to him through whom they come. For it is more profitable him if a weighty millstone is put around his neck and he has been cast into the sea than that he may cause one of these little ones to stumble. So in other words, it would be a lot easier on you if you, put a heavy weight on you and tossed in the water and you're going to die. Basically, very simply, you're going to die. That's more merciful to you than if you cause someone else to stumble. This is a rather big deal. That's why I would suggest when you hear in James, the idea of the teacher is going to be someone who teaches is subject to a little bit more scrutiny, shall we say. So I think this is important, and I would say that's consistent with 16 in the sense of leadership, leading people astray. And one of the good examples is the unrighteous manager, the dishonest manager, who made deals with, you know, as I termed them, customers. So they all acted as thieves. One caused, or at least facilitated, another to stumble, or but woe to him through whom they come. So that stumbling, the dishonest manager said, hey, I have a way where we can both make some serious money here. And of course, you're going to take care of me afterwards, right? I would suggest it's consistent here. But one of the things that really stands out, verse 3, take heed to yourselves, and if your brother may sin in regard to you, rebuke him, and if he may change his mind, forgive him. Okay. Take heed yourself. If your brother may sin in regard to you, what happens if something I said yesterday, or something I'm saying now, or something I've said in some of these other videos, or in writing, or in my postcards, or wherever, if I've said something that is wrong, I mean wrong to the point that it's blatant sin, and I don't know it, it's unclear to me, I'm just completely missing it. And somebody, especially somebody this has been addressed to, hears this, sees this, and says, aha, he sins. But he doesn't rebuke me. Take heed to yourselves, and if your brother may sin in regard to you, rebuke him. In other words, if I've said something wrong, if, you know, if I, for example, if I make the case that institutional leadership has done this, that, or the other that's inappropriate, and either partially or fully, just even partially wrong in what I've stated, then I'm making a false accusation, then it's sin on my part. The command to you is to rebuke me. I've used the expression for years, correct me where I'm wrong. I want the correction. And I got to be really careful so I don't get too long here. But you should be familiar with Leviticus 19. Because there's an important verse there where, and again, I have the LSV up, but I'm going to stick with it. Verse 18 is a rather big deal. I mean, a whopper of a verse. You know, considering the two greatest commandments, it's number two. But verse 17, do not hate your brother in your heart. You certainly reprove your fellow. Do not permit sin on him. Do not take vengeance nor watch the sons of your people, and you have had love for your neighbor as yourself. I am Yahweh. Let me read that in the ESV to make it a little bit easier. You shall not hate your brother in your heart, but you shall reason frankly with your neighbor, lest you incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. A rather significant verse. Again, this is the source of what Christ calls one of the two greatest commandments. So love your neighbor as yourself. And one of the ways you love your neighbor is you rebuke him. You contend with him. You correct him. You reason frankly with him. Silence. Running in a corner. Hiding. I would contend from what we see in Luke 17, and even more from what we see in Leviticus 19, is a grievous sin because it fits under the umbrella of loving your neighbor as yourself. And one way to not do that is not to correct or rebuke a brother and allow him to continue in sin. So where I am in sin, in the things I proclaim, if you have any love for your brother, your neighbor, correct me. Or perhaps you could say, well, maybe he's right, so I'm going to keep my mouth shut because you're the one in sin. And who's the one doing the act of love? Think about that one. But the other thing that I think we should keep in mind is, you know, you have Luke 17:3. But if your brother may sin in regard to you, rebuke him. But another verse that I use a lot, Matthew 5:23. If therefore you may bring your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother has anything against you, leave your gift there before the altar. First be reconciled to your brother, and then having come, bring your gift. I use this constantly. There remember your brother has anything against you. They're not identical. The context is not the same. But I suggest both are rooted in the Leviticus 19. Love your neighbor. But I point out here, over and over again, I point out the fact that the Matthew 5, if your brother has anything against you, it's not if you have something against your brother. You know, in Luke 17, if your brother may sin in regard to you, you're the victim. Matthew 5, if your brother has anything against you. In a sense, you may be the victim because you may be falsely accused, or you may be appropriately accused in the sense he has something against you because you have sinned against him. There is no qualifier in the Matthew 5. It could be either way. But it's your duty to reconcile with a brother, even if it's not your fault. But then, even more, if your brother is sinning, you need to rebuke him. So there's some weight on others, and obviously this is where I'm striving to do my part in this, in the sense that I will contend those who close their minds and hearts to someone who is reaching out. What is it? Genesis 42:21. When we saw the distress in his soul, when he begged us and we would not listen. Did I say that right? Then they said to one another, "In truth, we are guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us and we did not listen." That is why this distress has come upon us. This is obviously the case of Joseph in Egypt. Again, my middle name is Joseph. And I've been begging and begging and begging. But, okay. And, of course, remember, and to keep it short, I'll stop here with this, but remember, who's your neighbor? If you look at me as your enemy, because I say things that you don't like, so I must be your enemy. When Jesus was asked, "Who is my neighbor?" And he gave the parable of the Good Samaritan. Who is your neighbor? The enemy. And we're called to love them. And then, of course, he ended with the "go and do likewise." So, people who have been my enemies, it's an act of love I'm trying to reconcile with you. I'm trying to fulfill the Luke 17:3. If your brother may sin in regard to you, rebuke him. If he may change his mind, forgive him. Well, I'm rebuking you. If you change your mind, which is seen in reconciliation, I will live the command to forgive you. So that's on the table. Yesterday's voicemail was a big deal. I made a stack of DVDs of that voicemail, and they went out in the mail today. I emailed a whole bunch of people about this, and I've already had a dialogue on it. I'm open to other dialogues. You know how to contact me. And of course, please, tell my wife, the woman I love and adore, I've committed my life to, and I think you can see I'm living it. Dorothy Jane, my lady, I love you.